Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Thank you all very much for coming. Before I briefly introduce our guest, let me start with our usual housekeeping notes. First of all, please, all of you, turn off your cell phones now. If everybody pulls them out at the same time, then you shouldn't be shy about doing it, but it interrupts the video and everything else if people have them going off. I just turned off mine on my walk over here. So please all turn them off now. Second of all, I'd like to tell you about our next event just coming up this evening. We have Professor Chen Baizhu, a very well-known Chinese economist. This is somebody who's a former president of China's Society of Economists. He is somebody who has trained with many of the most prominent people in economic policy making in China. We're very fortunate to have him as our dinner speaker this evening. We still have about 20 seats left for that event, and we'd love to see some of you here again tonight. Also, a couple of other events coming up. We've got the Malaysian Minister of Government Management and Accountability coming up on the 21st. That's also a dinner. Tony Tyler, however, the CEO of Cathay Pacific, has already sold out, but if you want to add your names to the waiting list, he's on the 17th. With that, I'd like to introduce our speaker today. Probably you've read the flyer, so you already know, and probably you've seen his name in print in many places frequently. Professor Wasserstrom has been known for many years as a commentator on China from Indiana, where he was one of the early people to really specialize in Chinese studies in the United States and form an international reputation doing so, to now at the University of California at Irvine. He's been particularly paid attention to the media, to internet, to some of the social and political controls that China retains. With that, here we go.
It's a great pleasure to be here. I've been to the Foreign Correspondents Club once before, not to speak, but to meet with Rebecca McKinnon, who was covered China for CNN. And then went on to be one of the really first analysts of the internet, which is one of the reasons I bring her up. And so this was a place where several years ago, meeting with her, I learned an enormous amount about politics and the internet, and now I'll try to teach a little bit about it. I do teach for a living, and I have a very loose lecture style. Today is going to be even looser than usual, though, because the topic, while there's a historical angle to it, it's also an event that I want to tie, a talk that I want to tie as much to what's going on right now in the world and in China. And since I started this brief trip through Asia, I got to Beijing about a week ago, and that was right when the crackdown on, or the increasing hassling of foreign journalists began, because of calls for so-called Jasmine protests in China that circulated on the internet and ended up with, as I'm sure many of you or all of you know, with protest events in which the number of security personnel and police far outnumber the number of people who turned up. And yet I think it's an important sign, despite the lack of physical bodies at the protest, of the power and concern about the power of new media, simply that the Chinese government responded the way it did. Now, I'm talking about the present and even doing a little bit of speculating about what's to come, but I am a historian. That's what my training is, and I hope that by the end of this presentation, you'll get a sense of how I haven't, even though I've moved into talking about the present and even sometimes about the future, I haven't abandoned the historical hat. And in fact, one of my basic arguments will be that if we want to understand the present and think about what's going to happen next, it's crucially important to think about the past, particularly about Chinese history. But not Chinese history the way it is invoked routinely by the Beijing regime now, which is a kind of unending, endless 5,000 years of particular civilizational values, Confucian ideas. That's not what I mean when I say paying attention to history. I mean paying attention to specific precedents for contemporary dilemmas and contemporary forms of action and contemporary acts of repression that have meaning in part because within China people have specific memories of what happened in periods like the 1911 revolution, the 1919 May 4th movement, of course June 4th, 1989, and they also, that there's an ongoing battle over the meaning of past events which keeps people very aware of the competing stories of them. Now, as I say, it's going to be kind of loose, and the PowerPoint won't always link up perfectly because I've been trying. I took some old images that I had and tried to link them to what I was trying to make up as I went. But I will begin with a brief reading, which I think will give it some control and also allow me to control my language and get across some of the main points. And here goes. I wrote this 10 days or so ago, and then we'll update. Have the latest changes, advances in communication technology radically altered the fundamental dynamics of struggles for change in authoritarian settings? Or have cell phones and social media merely brought about small shifts in the dynamics of revolution? Is the web a godsend to those trapped in repressive states, as Nobel laureate Liu Xiaobo suggests in his essay called "The Internet is God's Gift to China"? Or does this thinking give in to a form of cyber-utopianism that glosses over the potential of new media to be used by autocrats, their propaganda ministries, and security forces to massage public opinion, keep tabs on dissidents, and ensure that populations stay docile and distracted, as Yevgeny Morozov argues in The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom, and he's the one who uses the term cyber-utopianism for people who think that Twitter and Facebook will save the world. This is a fascinating moment to ponder the questions I've just described, due both to what is happening on the streets in the Middle East and in the offices of publishing, where Morozov's book is just one of many to stake out bold claims about the pros and cons of the newest new media. When it comes to mass protests, it can seem that cyberspace changes everything. This is the implication of a strain of analysis that generated references to a Twitter revolution when demonstrations broke out in Tehran in 2009, and that has more recently led some to present the 2011 struggle in Tahrir Square as fueled by Facebook. But it's also clear that many things that were part of the revolutionary mix long before the arrival of blogs and Blackberries still matter. Many of us kept up with the developments in Cairo by looking at displays on decidedly 21st century devices like iPads and smartphones. But what we saw in pixels often looked like scenes the French painter Jacques-Louis David presented in brushstrokes in 1789. When disaffected Egyptians erected barricades, they were doing something that was already old hat when it was done by the Paris Communards in the 1870s. Turning from politics to publishing, Adam Gopnik of The New Yorker provides a thoughtful and stylish analysis of the burgeoning literature on the internet in a recent issue of his magazine. His essay is far from comprehensive and focuses more on social and cultural life than politics, one reason perhaps that he makes no mention of Morozov's politically minded book. But Gotnip offers a tripartite categorization scheme that I find useful for thinking about media and revolution right now. He says that analysts of the internet often take an optimistic, never better approach, the world's never been better, a pessimistic, better never one, if only the internet and Facebook hadn't been invented, or they make ever was claims that what we're seeing is just things we've seen before. Works in the first category highlight the liberating, solidarity-creating effects of digital formats, while those in the second stress their alienating and fragmenting effects. The ever-was types, by contrast, dismiss the notion that we are in a completely novel era at all, despite all of our new toys. They draw attention to parallels between the current debates associated with and fantasies generated by cyberspace and those that were linked to and triggered by the printing press, telegraph lines, and television, when those now very old media were new. It's easy to imagine that a group of scholars is already at work somewhere making plans to hold a conference on the theme of media and revolution next year. They may, as I'm speaking to you, be busy compiling lists of specialists in various fields who could be called together to place current events into historical perspective by comparing and contrasting, say, the role of petitions spelled out on paper in the American Revolution and tweets and text messages in Tunisia. As someone who has worked on dissent in China, I could easily be imagined that I would be invited to such a conference. And if I was invited, I'd be tempted to go. I'd want to learn about what was going on in the Middle East. I'm sure if I went there to this conference that I'm imagining for next year, I'd find it a fascinating learning experience. But it would also trigger a strong sense of deja vu. You see, I've already been to a conference just like the one I've been describing. It, too, was convened in the wake of a surprising series of risings, some abortive and some successful, that found crowds gathering in central squares to call for an end to corruption and autocratic rule. That conference, though, which was held in Lexington, Kentucky, exactly 20 years before the one I've been imagining, was held back when the most talked about public square, beginning with the letter T, was Tiananmen and not Tahrir, and when it was footage of protests and repression on CNN, as opposed to YouTube and Al Jazeera, that seemed to be taking us into a radically new phase in the history of revolutions. So what my basic point is, and I end up in the ever was category, new media make a difference in the specifics of protests, the way they spread, the forms they take. But the fundamental aspect of the protest phenomenon does not get completely transformed by these changes. And I went back and I dug up the book that grew out of that 1992 conference that I described. It came out in 1995, was called Media and Revolution. And reading through that conference, which was talking about how satellite television and fax machines, remember fax machines, had totally changed the dynamics of protest and autocracy around the world. Much of it seems very resonant with what is happening or I'm thinking about today. And so one of the things that I ended my chapter by saying was in 1989, both sides, the government and the protesters, made use of new technologies, but they also relied heavily on familiar forms of mass action. Mobilizing large groups of people to take to the streets, gather in central squares, and participate in symbolically charged performances remains an effective way to challenge or defend the legitimacy of those who claim to embody the political center and have legitimacy within a society. So the argument then was that we were in a totally new area because of the new technologies of the day, including television, which inspired all of the same kinds of discussion. It's ruining culture, it's leading to short attention spans among our youth. All of these things that are now being said about the internet were being said about television. Many of the things that are now being said about the internet, like it annihilates all sense of time and distance, were said about the telegraph before then. The world was suddenly knit together in ways it never had because of this thing, this technology that magically transmitted news around the world instantaneously. That was said about the telegraph long before the internet. So my argument is that in the end, what really matters and what really mattered in Egypt was people turning out in public squares, physical bodies, however the role that Facebook and so forth did in getting them there. So this is the plea to keep history in mind. And I'll give some other examples of how history can matter as well. If you're intrigued by anything I say, there's more about much of it in my book that's for sale out there, which is framed as a series of answers to commonly asked questions about China. And I then try to give both information and sort of flip assumptions upside down. So for example, one assumption I try to flip upside down that's relevant for the discussion here, and I think we should be aware of, is there's a common assumption that the fall of communist states in Eastern Europe was going to damage the Chinese Communist Party. What I argue there was, in fact, in many ways, it made the Chinese Communist Party stronger. It gave them a diagnostic lead. They could see how those states, like them, had unraveled and try to avoid allowing the same conditions to happen in their country. They knew that one reason why Communist Party states fell in Eastern and Central Europe was because there was not a vibrant consumer culture. People in East Berlin could look over to West Berlin and see that people had better stuff, not to belittle the role that ideas played in it, but that was a key part of it. The Chinese Communist Party looked at that and realized that people in Shanghai could look over at Hong Kong and see that people in Hong Kong had better stuff. Much classier department stores, much more exciting things to watch on television. So after 1989, the distance culturally and materially between Shanghai and Hong Kong, as you know, began to disappear. There's not now the gap that there was between East Berlin and West Berlin when you move from Shanghai to Hong Kong. My friends in Shanghai, when I came here in the mid-1980s, told them I was going to Hong Kong. They looked at me like, tell me when you get back, is this the magical place that we've heard it is? Now I tell people in Shanghai I'm going to Hong Kong next, and they say, so what? With the historical side, since I had Sun Yat-sen in the title, and Hong Kong is a place that's important in Sun Yat-sen's life, so I should talk about him, and it's the 100th anniversary of the 1911 revolution. And here I just wanted to say that Sun Yat-sen's revolution was fueled in part by the new technologies of the day. The map here shows telegraph lines that were, as cables were being laid across large land masses and then under oceans, it began to knit the world together in new ways. And the other thing that mattered in shifts of technology at that point were not just technology of communication, but also technology of transportation. Sun Yat-sen could go to America to raise money from Chinese ethnic Chinese communities in America to then help fuel his revolutionary plans in China. He could move by steamship and by other new technologies of transportation. And telegraphs could keep these activists in different parts of the world together. Most importantly, telegraphs within China could communicate information about what was happening in one part of the country to another. The telegraph was a crucially important new technology in transforming what could have been localized movements into national movements. So the new technology of the telegraph at that point was crucial in nationalizing protest. It didn't necessarily change the basic things that got people angry at the Qing dynasty, but it allowed them to link up from place to place much more effectively. The first movement after 1911 in which telegraph petitions were one of the main modes of communication in the May 4th movement of 1919, which was one of the most, I'll linger on that and Tiananmen because they're two of the best known protest movements in China, ones that have particular resonance and arguments about them. So that was one fueled by a new media of the time, the telegraph. But also, what mattered, as you see in these images, were protesters taking risks with their bodies to try to bring about change, to show how committed they were to the ideas that they had shown that they had spelled out in their telegraph petitions. Right, about 1989, since this is one of the most interesting things to look at, I think, in putting the current debate about media and revolution into a kind of historical perspective and a China perspective. And I think it's crucial to remember that the current government, when it thinks about the possible dangers of protesters, is always thinking about what has happened, not just what is happening in places like the Middle East, but what has happened in their country in the past. And they're concerned about anything in China that has any parallel to the Middle East, but they're seeing that through the question, could this lead to something that would have some kind of parallel to things we've seen in our own country? The power of Tiananmen movement in an international phase, in an international sense, was defined in part by how these powerful images circulating by the new media of satellite television resonated with audiences around the world. The goddess of democracy in America in particular was seen as uncannily like the Statue of Liberty and allowed a kind of empathetic attachment to the protesters by foreign audiences who thought, in part because of the images circulating, that the Chinese were doing something so much like what Westerners had felt important. And then the image of the massacre, of course, this being the most famous iconic photograph of that, also resonated internationally and again echoed a sense of the lone individual standing up against the repressive state. What I want to stress, though, is in the wake of the Tiananmen protests and the June 4th massacre, the same new media that were seen as in part giving sustenance and support for the protesters by having audiences around the world feel this special resonance and kinship with the protests were immediately used by the authoritarian state to try to transform the meaning of and control the message of the crackdown and the violence. So this image was shown initially on Chinese television, but with a different kind of narrative. What they showed was not just the tanks standing off against the man, but the tanks moving to avoid hitting the man. The man then climbing up aboard the tanks and then running away, being able to leave. And this was used and shown on television to try to combat the protesters and protest sympathizers' version of events and to claim, see how much restraint we showed as a state and see how crazy this man was. And there were all sorts of other uses of selectively edited and reworked images of what had happened, used by presentations through the same new media that was seen as sort of liberating the world, it was also used by the authoritarian state to reposition itself and try to gain control of the story about those events. And it was also used quite explicitly, at least in some cases, to lead to the arrest of people who were the intercepted of the satellite broadcasts. So somebody who was talking about trying to spread to the word the news of what had happened in Tiananmen Square, or near Tiananmen Square with the violence, was then picked up by the authorities after an image of him being interviewed was circulated on Chinese TV, and people were asked, anybody who knew of his whereabouts, to turn him in. So that's an example. Now is the same thing we're hearing about the internet can both link together protesters, but it can also, the new technologies, and particularly cell phones as well, can be used to monitor where people are in new ways. The Tiananmen protest then spread the word of it through many different kinds of media, including American television shows. The Simpsons, as one sign of its fame, had not just one but two references to 1989 in Tiananmen. This is my favorite one. Sums up the government's effort to squash out any memory of this. 1989, one WAG talking about the fact that new media were being seen as changing all calibrations within China because news from the outside world could be faxed into China and get around censors. Talked about it, we've gone from seeking truth from fax to within China seeking truth from fax, F-A-X. The discourse about the role of the fax machine circumventing the censors because they couldn't keep up with the new technologies fast enough is very similar to the discourse now of people making clever uses of the internet, skating around the great firewall or circumventing the net nanny to sneak information or alternative views into China by using words that the censors haven't figured out yet need to be blocked. One of the most surreal things about the last couple of weeks have been all the words that the censors have begun blocking, not just protest, you know, you could imagine that, but they ended up blocking the word jasmine because the Jasmine Revolution was, and that was tricky because one of the most popular songs, a popular song that actually Hu Jintao has shown on a video singing has the word jasmine in it. But most surreal was last week when they, for a time, apparently blocked the word today from the internet because there were calls for protest today. Okay, here we are in the era of Facebook and the different kinds of images that are being used to suggest something that I think, again, what I wanted to say about the Goddess of Democracy is the Goddess of Democracy, especially in the U.S., was played as being just like the Statue of Liberty. But in fact, the most powerful symbols of the protests in 1989 in China itself were often invocations of by the students to say they were carrying forth the May 4th movement of 1919. They were carrying forth a specifically Chinese patriotic tradition of youthful protest against corrupt authorities. Here, too, you see, I think, an overstating of the degree, yes, Facebook was important, but when you see images like this, which actually resonate with that, summing the protests up only with Facebook, paying less attention to the other kinds of slogans and things that have specific Arab connotations, I think runs the risk of overstating the way to which photogenic images that people inside a country know will play well internationally may be over-accentuated. And we've seen that before with Tiananmen. So this would be just the example. The 1989, while seen in much of the rest of the world as in step with the events going on in Eastern Europe and perhaps in step with long-term traditions of battles for liberty, the West, were seen within China by the protesters presented themselves to foreign audiences often by quoting internationally recognizable legible slogans. In Chinese discourse said, we're just patriotic students standing up against a corrupt regime just like the May 4th heroes of 1919 who we've grown up hearing celebrated about. All right, I'll skip forward to the end because I want to have time for lots of questions. I think the key thing about post-1989 protests in China has been there's been a flexible response to protests with one of the key metrics being to avoid, but part of the state cracks down hard on anything that looks like it have the potential to resemble the events that took place either in China or in other parts of the world in 1989 that ended up bringing down communist parties. So in some cases, when something strikes a certain kind of chord of potential resonance, there's a boot on the face, no holds barred kind of crackdown thing. You see that with Falun Gong. And you see it with Falun Gong, I think, not because of the specific ideas or goals of Falun Gong, but because Falun Gong was something that was affecting people in multiple social groups and in multiple cities through China. That was one of the things that tips the balance toward repression. What there's much more tolerance of, and not this kind of boot on the face thing, are single issue protests, single locale protests, single social group protests, things that have no organization behind them. When I commented in the mid-1990s to the fact that there seemed to be more freedom of expression on certain subjects, freedom of activity than I had expected post-Tiananmen, one of the smartest things said about post-Tiananmen China was said to me by a bartender on a cruise ship who said, the watchword now is Meiyou Yundong Shemadokui. If it's not a movement, anything goes. But if it's a movement, forget it. And I think this is important to remember with these kind of phantasms of calls for jasmine protests, which don't seem to have anything real meaty behind them, but were calls for protests in many different cities and for people of many different walks of life, and with a very generalized kind of grievance to gather together and take to the streets. I was bringing up, I think, one of the other crucial things of the tolerated protest versus not tolerated protest. Protests that target a foreign country are tolerated much more than those that target the government. But the government, with its memory of Tiananmen, is still nervous about patriotic protest of any kind, because the Tiananmen protesters were intensely patriotic. So nationalist protests or anti-foreign protests are tolerated briefly, but the government knows, again from its own history, that students on the streets, after they begin, or young people, after they begin talking about complaining about another country, often then segue to talking about, wouldn't it be better if we were ruled by better people at home? So I was in China in 1999. The only protests that I'm talking about that I observed directly for the anti-NATO protests that were often described as government-controlled, but I think were much more government-steered and the government jumping ahead of and then reining back in as soon as they got worried. But I will skip through that. And I want to end by talking about one final metric about shifts in protest over time of concerns from the 1970s and 1980s to the present, which I think is worth lingering on, which is that in the 1970s and late 70s and 80s, the big question on the minds internationally was whether China would be able to become a thoroughly modernized country or a truly modernized country, a place that could compete with the West in terms of economic and material activities. And even protesters, when they called for greater democracy in China, and I think this was true of Democracy Wall and also true of Tiananmen, claimed that one thing that they were angry about with the government, it wasn't transparent enough, it wasn't democratic enough, it was too corrupt, and that would prevent the economy from developing. That would keep China from becoming a strong country. Wei Jingsheng, in his famous document, The Fifth Modernization, said, we need the four modernizations that Deng Xiaoping is talking about, but we won't get modernized industry, science, and education unless we have a fifth democracy first, a fifth modernization first. And that modernization is democracy. Without democracy, his wall poster said, economic development will face insurmountable obstacles. If you flash forward to the present, what we actually find is a modernized China in which protests, at least in the cities, heavily modernized. Protests are largely people saying the concern around the world is that China has modernized without democratizing. And when there are protests, they're often about people complaining about not having enough of a say in the way modern forms of activity and life are being imposed on them. So the protests that I showed here, and this has a particular relevance for what's going on in China right now, were protests against the extension of the magnetic levitation train, a symbol of China's surge to being a top-tier country in certain ways. People in the center of Shanghai didn't want the extension of this train line through the center of the city because they feared it would bring down their housing prices and they'd just become invested in houses. and they feared it would cause noise pollution, and they feared it would threaten the safety of their children. So they called for something, and this was the same thing was being done with environmental protests in other cities in China, for people not to have a confrontational protest that would get the government too unnerved, but to simply go for a stroll to call attention to their concerns. So the term sanbu, just going for a stroll, as opposed to a demonstration, was called for, and this was largely tolerated. And in fact, the magnetic levitation train, the people were caught, their main grievance where they said, we should have been consulted before this extension, were the people affected by this. The government delayed the expansion of the train line. So in a sense, it was a successful protest in that way. Some people were arrested, but there wasn't a lot of use of force. This stroll technique was something that seemed to be working. In Shanghai, it being Shanghai, in other places they were calling for strolls. In Shanghai, the other term they used for going out onto the streets in a non-confrontational way was just go out shopping. So that was something that the Shanghainese thought would be a nice way to express. It is, again, that same terminology of sanbu, simply strolling, going out on the streets to show you're concerned about something, is exactly what the Jasmine protests that were called for online led to this incredibly harsh response as opposed to this very calm response by the authorities. Here I think we see that what's new is the fact that the sanbu and the stroll this time, which very few strollers took, was being called for in many different cities and did not have just a specific cause in mind. But I think this shift from protest demanding democracy or greater rights so that your economy can boom, so that your country can assert itself and become a strong country, to a shift where the protests are much more about complaints about the quality of life or the lack of say in issues as China has surged forward modern. And I think that's one of the ways to even think about the protests in Tibet, which are partly about religious independence or identity, but are also triggered by a complaint about the developing of Tibet process in which Tibetans are having too little say. Nobody wants to have modernization shoved down their throat. So now you have this very different kind of setting, and I think it does separate out what's going on in China very much from what's going on in places like Egypt, where there's a feeling that more like what used to be in China, that the country is being held back from moving forward, there was under Mubarak, by this kind of regime that wasn't able to do things in an efficient modern way. And that was one of the things that people were angry about, to a different kind of setting where people feel that part of the thing that's making life disquieting is how quickly the country's changing, how much it's surging without certain kinds of freedoms. But when we think about, this is very different than about Egypt and about China. On the other hand, though, what we see in Egypt is some things happening to trigger protests that from a Chinese government perspective looks disturbingly like some of the factors that were in play in earlier periods when there were protests that challenged them. The people in Egypt have been angry about high inflation, an educated class that doesn't feel they're getting to become part of the decision-making process within the government, and also are worried about their economic future, and a feeling of a corrupt authoritarian group in power. All the things I've just described, plus one other thing about Mubarak, the fact that he was backed by America, were true of Chiang Kai-shek in the late 1940s when protests toppled him. That's one of the things the Chinese Communist Party is haunted by. They don't want themselves to end up in the situation of the power group that they toppled. But the other time when you had a combination of inflation, worries about the economic future by highly educated, articulate people, and anger about corruption was in 1989. The protests were not just about abstract desires for democracy, there was also a backdrop of economic insecurity. So when you put all those things together, the worry about the possibility of things happening in multiple places at once, the worry about inflation, the worry about economy, and the ongoing enduring problem of corruption, you start seeing how even a very vague, chimerical call for Jasmine-type protests could trigger this kind of otherwise very bizarre and strange overreaction by the Chinese government. Thanks.
They've replaced our microphones. Why don't I throw the floor open for questions right away? Yes, right over here, please.
Thanks very much. I was wondering, you've been mentioning in terms of the internet, the great firewall of China, I think you mentioned internet censorship. How much of that is actually wanting to censor what goes on in the internet? Because it's very easy to get around. If you're living in Beijing, you can just apply for a virtual private network and get whatever you like. It's a bit slower, but it's okay. And how much of it is actually trying to prevent foreign companies coming in and taking a share in the booming internet market? I mean, mostly it's homegrown search engines providers. I mean, what's the balance there, do you think?
Okay. I'll answer in a couple parts. First of all, it's quite easy to get around the censorship mechanism. I tend to use net nanny rather than great firewall, and I'll explain why. Great firewall suggests something that is much more effective at blocking, whereas the net nanny is used by Jeremy Goldcorn of Donway.org, one of the most insightful media analysts, to talk about the government's effort to steer people toward things that they think will be good for them, to make the same way a nanny would guide you toward good books to read rather than troubling ones. What the government wants is most people, most of the time, looking for a quick answer to something, which is how many people use the internet everywhere, to be led to the things it approves of rather than the things they disapprove of. If you want to spend a little bit of time and energy to get around these kinds of controls and to get to alternative news source things, then you're able to do it, but you're in a segment of the population that isn't the great majority of this. So they're doing two things. They're blocking, or several things. They're blocking certain kinds of sites, and they're also now hiring people to flood the internet with opinions that reinforce the government's line on things. So what they're trying to do is create a kind of manipulated sort of sense of public opinion, the possibility of the internet being a kind of public sphere. They want to kind of steer it in a certain ways. They know that there's a kind of person that that isn't going to be influenced by their version of events, but they want the people who are just casual consumers of news and information to be influenced by their thing. So I think that's a bigger concern with this than the specific competition one, though I think that's another part of it as well. But I think we shouldn't be fooled by thinking just because you can get a VPN and get around it, the little bit of time, the little bit of money that it costs to do that makes it something that the vast majority of people aren't going to do. So the kind of people who get access to alternative news sources, the kind of people who travel abroad, or the kind of people who come to Hong Kong where there's a different kind of media system there in play. So I think that's crucial. Another way you can see this is what you can say in the English language press or English language settings in China is much freer than what you can say in purely Chinese language things. Because again, it's a smaller segment of the population that's being exposed to these potentially challenging things. And it can sometimes fool foreign commentators into thinking that Chinese public discourse is freer than it actually is. Because they'll say, no, I mean, there's a lot of room for variable opinion on certain things. In China Daily, they had two different opinions expressed. I mean, it doesn't happen that often, even in China Daily. But so I think this is one of the things, to think about who the targeted audience is. And what the government is most concerned is about that casual user of the internet. And face it, most people in China, most of the time, like most people everywhere, are not going onto the internet trying to get critical ideas about things. They're going to shop, to look for people to date, to stay in touch with other people. And then casually getting information that way, the way they would casually get it from other kinds of news source. So if what they're exposed to in those kind of casual activities reinforces the government view, that's all to the good there. Thanks for the question.
Okay. Over here in the corner, and then over here on the side.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that one of the drivers that leads populations to rise up against oppressive governments is the fact that they're able to see that other people have better stuff. And I wonder if you have any views on North Korea, therefore, and as new technology does seem to be getting in there, how is that regime going to survive?
That's a great question. I think that's... there are degrees of control. I think the way in which North Korea is trying to deal with this is to try to limit as much awareness as possible of what's available anyplace else. China had reached a point where, because of its embracing of economic reforms or liberalization, that wasn't an option. There was too much information about what was going on elsewhere to simply fool people into thinking that there weren't better things over there. I know with North Korea, it's often seen as one of the most politically unsettling things when information comes in to this relatively closed system that contradicts the government's line about South Koreans being poor, or South Koreans being poorer than North Koreans. So I think this is actually something, if we're looking at North Korea, that's one of the things to focus on. I think it explains the really hardcore control of the internet, because even a censored internet, it would be very hard to censor out all information that showed how lifestyles were in other parts of the world. So they actually are trying to control exposure, not just the internet, but to popular culture products that show other places. So it's more that China and Eastern Europe, before 89, had moved into a situation where they were allowing a fair amount of circulation of popular culture internationally, and sort of, I guess, hoping that people wouldn't really notice how much what was going on in the country undermined the fundamental original claim of state socialist regimes, was that not only would they be more egalitarian, but they would be able to keep up with or surpass the capitalist world in terms of creature comforts. And that was just totally undermined. And I think some of the smartest analysts of Eastern Europe have drawn attention to that aspect of the loss of faith in communism in Eastern Europe. Was partly about loss of faith in the ideology, but it was partly loss of faith in that promise of material wealth there. Hope that answers it.
Right here, please.
And in fact, when North Korean defectors go to China and come back, the stories they tell about the fact that in China people can eat meat a couple of times a day is very destabilizing, is kind of the story that comes back. For North Korea, I would suggest reading, if you haven't, Barbara Demick's Nothing to Envy, I think, gets this across incredibly well. The title of it comes from the fact that a slogan in North Korea was, we have nothing to envy. You know, nobody's doing better than we are. So.
Yeah, I'm Toh Han Chi from the South China Morning Post. To what extent do you think the Chinese government has a deliberate policy of what you so-called managing dissent? In other words, allowing a semblance of dissent in order to avoid real serious dissent. You know, the Chinese phrase, Xiao ma da bang mang. For example, the media or the newspapers or the internet, you know.
I think there's both an awareness that there needs to be certain kinds of relief valves to allow people to express certain kinds of things. I think they've come up with a very complicated way of treating different protests differently. And that's also a way, I think that's also a way to keep different kinds of discontented groups from coalescing. So that I think you can, you know, and so we've seen this with a certain amount of tolerance for individual strikes at individual factories, though complete crackdown on anything that looks like a multi-sided autonomous union. I mean, it's a very sophisticated strategy, and I think it has a lot of different elements to it. I think one of the things that makes the internet so disconcerting to the regime is that it's just such a chaotic space that it's harder to keep a set amount of policies toward it. So I don't know. I don't know if that answers it, but I think they realize that completely cracking down on any expression of discontent is not going to work. and seems to lead to greater instability for a structure. Though it can work as long as the elite is completely unified, but they're worried about that. But there needs to be some kind of safety valve. That was the term I was looking for. So they come up with this complicated thing. So complaints about local corruption can actually be tolerated or sometimes even lead to results. But complaints about top-level corruption then fall into a different category. And so this kind of allows them to say, see, no, we're not just blocking out any concern with corruption. In fact, they can even look at protests against or crusading journalists against local corrupt officials as almost, they can say, this is helping us because we do need, we're committed to weeding out corruption. So it allows them to reposition themselves in ways that just complicate the possibility for broad-based, multi-class, multi-sided protests, which is what they fear the most because of Tiananmen and because of what happened in various parts of the world in 89.
Okay, we have time for one last question, and back here in the corner, please.
Hello, I'm Verna Yu, also from the South China Morning Post. My question is, the Jasmine rallies, do you see that it could roll into something more serious and something bigger? I've talked to a lot of analysts, and they seem to be of this opinion that the economy in China is still good, people still have money in their pockets, is not going to get into anything more serious and more threatening for the regime. I just want to know what your view is on this, and in the way that that you know the people keep calling out for more people to congregate every week. That seems to be pretty unprecedented. And what do you think the future is going to be?
Well, I just read a piece by one of my the smartest analysts of China as well as some other places. Howard French, formerly the New York Times and now at Columbia School of Journalism, who was talking about, he just wrote a piece on the Atlantic website saying there's been a tendency to describe to sort of dismiss these Jasmine protests as a failure. But he says that part, and that may well be in some ways, but that one of the goals of perhaps of the protests or protests in general in an authoritarian state are to kind of get an authoritarian state to show its true colors. And that by showing, it sort of has showed brought to our attention the continuing insecurity of the Chinese government at certain moments, at a time when the Chinese government is often trying to present itself as quite self-confident and in control. So I think it's very complicated to talk about whether something's a success or a failure. Another point he makes that I think is important is, while there are many things that are different about Egypt, and I would say the same thing, one thing we need to be really conscious of and keep reminding ourselves is that analysts weren't predicting Egypt to explode. So I think there's a need for, at moments like this, for real humility among journalists and among academics to just acknowledge the, and I was part of a group, as many were, when the Tiananmen protests began. It wasn't that we were surprised when they were eventually repressed, but we were surprised by how long they were allowed to unfold. And then we allowed ourselves to get caught up in the idea that somehow they might keep going, and then we were surprised at the moment of the crackdown. So I think this whole process now, we should, with Egypt, we should feel humble because no, people weren't predicting it. And with the Chinese government's response, we should also feel humbled by the fact that we have so little idea of what's going on within the top leadership group when we try to understand this. Is really a time, again, for a kind of humility. Despite all the energy put covering China, trying to make sense of it, when somebody says to me, is this a sign of insecurity in the leadership succession? I say, I don't know. And that's not what I work on. But the people who work on that also need to say, they don't know. So there is a sense in which I think we need to have, we need to accept how little we know about what goes on in the inner workings. And I think we need to realize that the Chinese Communist Party leadership, how insecure and unaware of exactly what's going on the web they are, which is part of what makes them so nervous. And again, the lack of predictability or the thing you would have dismissed at the moment and then suddenly something bigger than you expected happened, and then there's a much bigger counter-reaction. That was something that happened with Falun Gong, precisely. None of the analysts were predicting that, or very few of them. The government, if you'd said there, you know, people are chattering about converging on, you know, in the center of Beijing for a sit-in, the government was taken largely unaware of that. And I think, so in that sense, this fear of the unknown in the Chinese leadership is still there, or fear of anything that echoes these past moments of surprise. But I think we have to be really be direct about the fact that we don't know exactly what degrees of happiness or discontent there are in all parts of China. It's an enormously complicated place. We don't know how much they'll resonate. So I'm not one who's predicting. I don't think of this as being the wedge that's going to transform China. We've seen too many things predicted for that didn't materialize after that. But I also think it is important to take it seriously, in part because if the government's scared about it, it reveals something important about them and their level of insecurity.
Okay. Thank you very much for those thoughtful answers and that thought in your speech. We really appreciate it. We'd like to give all of our guests something to remember their visit hereby.
Thank you.
And we hope to see many of you at further events. Thank you all for coming.
Thanks very much.